This is Talking Asset Management with KPMG, and today's episode is about treaties and independent agents.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Talking Asset Management with KPMG. Today, we are continuing our credit series. I'm Scott Woods, and I'll be talking today with Kyle Phillips and Sam Riesenberg. We're going to be talking about treaties and independent agents and take a little bit deeper dive than sometimes we normally do. So first, we'll get started and talk about a little bit of difference between, you have the IRS code, which governs a lot of what we do from a tax law perspective, and then you have these treaties. Tell me a little bit about how those two interact. Kyle?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Scott. So generally, when we're looking at these types of inbound fact patterns, we generally look at a fact pattern and we analyze it under the U.S. tax code, and we determine what the U.S. tax considerations are for a particular set of facts. We then have to determine whether or not we then qualify for treaties, and to the extent a particular treaty could somehow change what the actual analysis done under the U.S. tax code is. So really, we're looking at both. We're determining what the U.S. tax considerations are under the code, and then determining how that potentially would change to the extent we do qualify for a tax treaty.
Okay, great. And you know, obviously, the being the credit series, our biggest issue is loan origination, and we've had podcasts on those, so we'll not go into that today. But you know, how does the treaty apply when you do have a potential loan origination situation?
Yeah. So when you're looking, if you do have a lending business, of course, the key consideration under the code is, do you have a trade or business? I know in prior podcasts we've discussed that, so we're not going to go into real detail here as to whether or not you do have a lending business in the United States. Oftentimes, in order to access U.S. markets, you need to have a manager or an agent who's acting on your behalf that's finding deals. This oftentimes could create a U.S. trade or business, which then potentially we then overlay the particular treaty to say that, well, even if you do have a U.S. trade or business, you do not have a U.S. PE. And of course, to the extent we don't have a U.S. PE by virtue of an agent, then that means we generally do not have any federal income tax on that potential business interest income. We're going to only discuss here on this podcast federal income tax, and it's important just to do a plug for our state and local tax colleagues in that oftentimes states do not conform with federal income tax treaties. So even if we do get an exemption under a particular treaty, there could still be some state and local tax considerations that need to be considered.
Great point. Yeah, no, it's always, you always want to make sure you bring your SALT guys in, which we've mentioned before as well. So how do treaty applies and what are the eligibility for treaty benefits?
Yeah, so just at a 10,000 foot level, to the extent you do qualify for treaty, it requires generally a two-prong test. One, you have to be a resident of a treaty jurisdiction, and then you have to satisfy particular other LOB articles, which are intended to generally prevent certain types of treaty shopping.
So Hank, I'm going to interrupt you real quick. And we had two abbreviations we've used so far, PE, which is permanent establishment, and then two, LOB, which you see a lot of people reference. And if you're not familiar, it's kind of hard to just intuitively know what LOB is, but I believe it's limitation of benefits, but maybe you just remind us of that.
Yes, thank you, Scott. That's right. And apologies for that. So yes, so when we are looking at the limitation on benefits article, it's a separate aspect of the treaty and generally is intended to prevent treaty shopping. So there's oftentimes 6 to 8 different articles within that LOB clause. Only thing that we do have to be concerned with is that we only have to satisfy one or more. And so to the extent that we are treated as a qualified resident of a jurisdiction, and then we do satisfy the LOB article, one of the 6 to 8 that we just mentioned, then that gives you access to the treaty and the host of benefits that come with being entitled to treaty benefits.
And then the kind of the heart of the matter that we want to talk about today is really the independent agents and what is, a dependent versus an independent agent. And, talk a little bit about, Sam, the difference between the legal and economic independence issues that we see.
Yeah, so the hardest issue with an emphasis, if you will, on the is the independent agent test and qualifying. As Kyle went through, there are some hurdles you need to get over. Somewhat unique to the U.S. tax system, if you're looking at this from a non-U.S. lens, with the LOB provision in particular. But once you get over that, you come into something that's probably very familiar to those that are treaty practitioners in every country, which is the issue of whether you have an agent in the U.S. who is independent. And the U.S. has not adopted the MLI. And so we don't have the additional issues you might be facing in you know, the MLI countries, but you do have some very difficult issues on whether to determine if a person in a fund context, in a credit loan origination inbound investment, like what we're talking about, is independent. And this is really, the table stakes are very big on this, right? As Kyle was saying, if you have a treaty structure with only an independent agent operating in the US, then you will end up in a situation with no federal tax potentially, because you have no PE to associate it with and the treaty prevents taxation. Or if you are operating through a dependent agent in the US, then you'd have, you know, full US taxation on, you know, your permanent establishment amount. So it's really, from a federal perspective, the entire difference in whether or not a structure works from a treaty perspective for credit inbound lending is whether or not you have an independent agent, obviously with all the other prerequisites as well. As Scott, as you were saying, that really comes down when we look at U.S. treaties to two separate but required analyses, first legal and second economic. The legal one is that agent independent from a legal perspective? Can they operate legally independently? And all of the aspects of that analysis are very difficult to determine in many of these situations. The second requirement, and they're both required, is that you have a economically independent agent. And what that basically means is that you can't have an agent be treated as independent if there is so much economic compulsion for them to do your bidding that they wouldn't be a viable entity otherwise. Might be one way to think about it. It's kind of a backstop to, you know, the substance of independence. And both of those aspects are required, and both of them are very difficult and involved in analyzing in the credit space, and typically.
So if there's all of the money is coming from one source for that agent, it's from an economic standpoint, it's a pretty difficult argument.
That's exactly right. So if you take an example of an agent who is completely, let's just assume they're completely legally independent. But as you say, let's say it's a credit fund manager and they just have one client who's a non-US, let's say family office, just make it very easy. Are they independent of that? Well, let's say legally we're very comfortable with that. But the concept is, from an economic perspective, aren't they going to listen to whatever that the one source of money tells them to do, right? Isn't, for all intents and purposes, they are dependent on that one source of funds. And we get this problem oftentimes when we have a really heavyweight investor, cornerstone investor, for example, in a fund. The question is, are you able to set up a situation where you are economically independent of that? We often find this issue in either the startup phase for a credit fund, right? They go out and get a cornerstone investor. If it's a non-US investor, the question is, okay, are we able to take a position that they're independent? Oftentimes, we're not able to get there on economic independence. The other situation is when they have a relatively small amount of assets under management compared to a big investor that wants to invest with them. They say, hey, you know, can we go in? And we might pause on economic independence and say, okay, well, you know, this is such a change for you. Can you increase your fund by, you know, whatever X percent? And are you still going to be, you know, independent of those people economically? And we have to go through the analysis of that. And it's oftentimes quite difficult to discern.
What other factors should people be thinking about besides that one? Let's say they're okay with that piece, but what else is out there to trip them up?
On the economic piece, there's not only the amount of money as a percentage concept, but there's also the number of clients that you have. There's very little guidance that tells us exactly what to do in the space, and there's certainly no directly applicable guidance in the fund space. So we have to start asking some questions, like what happens if you have, you know, five different pools of capital, right? So technically, could you lose one of them, right? You know, obviously relative size matters. Some people would say, I want to see at least, you know, a certain number of accounts, right? Because then the likelihood, you being able to say, they tell you to do something, you say no, they say we're going to walk kind of analysis, then maybe we might turn around and say, okay, well, yeah, you probably need a good number of accounts as well as, you know, the right, you know, amount of accounts. And also a bit of an analysis of what's going to happen after the person theoretically leaves, right? We do a lot of theoretical analysis in these things. So we say, okay, the person's going to leave because they're upset. Let's put aside whether they can or not. That's more in the legal piece. But they leave and, you know, or they don't renew or re-up for investment with you because they're upset with you, or they threaten to. Are you going to be viable? Are you going to have to fire people because they left, right? You don't have enough business as a manager to continue in the same vein. Are you going to have to downsize your offices, move off Park Avenue? You know, whatever the analysis is, you kind of want to think through that whole, you know, cycle of it, right? If you're a $5 billion shop and you're losing, you know, a $50 million client, that's going to hurt, right? It hurts to lose any client, but you're probably not moving out of your offices, right? You're not, none of the key people are leaving the fund as a result of that, I think, in many cases. So that's some of the analysis that we would take from that perspective.
Sounds like obviously a lot of due diligence is required when you're making this analysis, and the key document there is going to be the investment management agreement, right? Tell me a little bit about the legal independence piece. You know, we talked about economic, but let's go into the legal aspects.
Sure. The other aspect of this is legal independence, and that means that you really are a separate legal entity. You know, that there's not something legally binding the two together, an agent principal relationship, such that, you know, that they become dependent from a legal standard. We certainly have legal relationships that create dependence, right? The classic one would be an employment type contract. But there's things that fall short of that legally that we think still substantively could be that way. The area that is probably the most difficult one to determine in this space is that of partnerships, and in particular, general partner, limited partner relationships, and the fiduciary duty that's created as a result of a general partner relationship is very unclear and probably messy, is probably the best way to say, in the area of treaty independence analysis. We have some case law in this area that tells us that general partners are generally analyzed at the partnership level for this analysis, and that their fiduciary duties under law create those types of relationships. We have some additional case law that tells us under a treaty that deemed general partnerships will create those types of relationships that are problematic. But we also have some substantive overlays that we need to be concerned about. And that's really how you're structuring your fund and the investors, you know, investment into the structure. The easiest thing to do is to have no partnerships. But we all know that that's very difficult in the fund investment space. So you have to have a partnership. You have to have some kind of entity. You're going to run into a lot of needing to negotiate with your tax counsel on how to really make that relationship legally independent.
Maybe Kyle, you want to talk a little bit about, you know, from that due diligence standpoint of looking at the, you know, independence aspect in the IMA?
Yeah, so oftentimes we're really trying to get a grasp on whether all the factors that Sam just mentioned are there, such that we know how to classify that particular manager as being an independent agent. We can do that via many different manners. We can have, of course, phone calls, and we can discuss, you know, what would be the economic ramifications or the legal considerations to the extent that we were to walk and the manager wouldn't get our business. You oftentimes want to put a little bit of teeth in that. And so when we're actually negotiating these IMAs, we would oftentimes ask a particular manager to make certain reps in the IMA as to these very key facts that we'd be looking for in order to determine that they are economically independent from us. Some of those reps that we've seen, just as an example, would lead be to the factors that Sam mentioned, right? We're one of many clients, they're manage assets under management of X, and then everything else really to just represent to the facts that we would want to see in order to put some teeth in the clauses and into those representations of fact that the manager has made to us.
A lot of things to consider. It sounds easy when you're in two treaty countries that might be beneficial in this situation, but a lot of things to to dive in and make sure your I's are dotted and T's are crossed for sure. With that, I think we'll wrap it up and appreciate you guys talking today. It's really, really good deep dive on the treaty and independent agents and things you need to consider. So thanks again, you guys, and thanks everyone for joining us today.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to Talking Asset Management with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series and visit read.kpmg.us/talking-asset-management for more information.